BTW and live theater is back. Black Theater Workshop and La Manufacture present Pipeline. We are back after 2 years with a dual language presentation of the off-Broadway hit Pipeline by Dominique Morisseau, translation by Mishka Lavigne. Pipeline shares the story of Nia, a single mother and teacher dedicated to the success of her students and her teenage son Omari. Tensions are mounting at his school, and Nia must find a way to rediscover her connection with her son and his connection with himself. Pipeline will be presented at Théâtre La Licorne from April 12th to 23rd in English and April 26th to May 8th in French. For tickets, call 514-523-2246 or visit théâtrelalicorne.com. This is a Black Theatre Workshop production and a CKUT co-presentation.
Is uncut. It contains strong language in some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
All the way live radio, CKUT 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5 p.m. This is Pro V. Thank you very much for tuning in. If you didn't catch last week's show, it was a real special Canadian show that I did because I dropped a Canadian hip-hop on vinyl website, northoftheborderhiphop.ca. That is northoftheborderhiphop.ca. When you go to the site, you can get mixes, you can get interviews. There is a vinyl gallery, which is basically, I took pictures of side A and B of all the records that I can get my hands on, all the 12-inch singles and all the albums, all the EPs. So I just want people to learn and educate themselves when it comes to this Canadian hip-hop that made things what it is now, and you know, everybody that paved the way for what it is today. So today's show is going to be revisiting an interview that I did a couple months ago with Red One from Rascals. You can find the interview up on the site, and but I just wanted to, you know, keep the theme going on All the Way Live because this is something that I've been working on for a while. So we got more interviews coming in the future, and more vinyl to add to the site. I'm going to be probably taking, you know, one day a month to keep adding to it as I get things. You know, people are hitting me up to say, hey, I got this, I got this, I got that to add to the site. And, you know, artists are hitting me up for interviews. So things are moving. I'll be able to provide people with a lot more moving forward, and I'm looking forward to it. So I hope you are too. Enjoy today's show. Like I said, Red One interview. And after that, just going to be some random Canadian hip-hop that, all mixed up, DJ style. So let's get into it. All the way live radio, CKUT 90.3 FM. Peace.
Thanks for taking the time to speak to me, man, to do this. Really appreciate it.
No problem, man. I appreciate it, too.
Yeah, man. Where you at now in the country?
I'm in Toronto right now.
Okay. Is that where
you're in? Montreal?
Yeah, I'm in Montreal. What? I'm in Montreal.
Yeah, I stay between here and Van, so it's like back and forth kind of thing, you know?
That's cool. At least keep it moving during COVID and keeps things, you know, fresh a little bit, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah, man. Kima told me you were born in New Jersey?
Yeah, I was born in the States, not New Jersey, in St. Croix.
Okay.
Oh, hold on.
Okay.
I was born in the Virgin Islands in the States, but then I moved to New Jersey like right after I was born.
Okay. And at what age, like how many years did you spend up there?
In the States?
Yeah.
Yeah, I moved to Canada when I was, I think, 8 years old.
Okay. You still got a good first part of your life down there.
I told mom, but I'm a Van City raised individual. I'm Van City all day, so Van City bred. Not born, but bred.
That's cool. And when did you meet Kimo, and when did you meet Misfit in your life?
We all met in high school. So I'd say probably I met Kimo in grade 8 because we went to the same high school. I met Fit and those guys probably around grade 9 or 10.
Okay.
They went to another high school in Burnaby. And we used to be B-boys, and they were B-boys, and they'd have all the underage parties, and you know, Fit and his crew would show up, and me and my crew would show up, and then we'd be battling those guys, and you know, we just became really good friends through the love of hip-hop and dance, and then we just took it to the next level and started making music ourselves.
That's cool, man. That's cool. Kimo said that you had heard a demo tape that him and another guy had put together, and that's what kind of linked you guys up musically.
I just remember Keem. I was working with this other mutual friend of ours, and I think he had, I don't know if it was a mixtape or a beat, he said that Christian made, which is Kimo's name, and and I knew him because we went to the same school. And I just remember, you know, hooking up with him and saying, yo, that's what you're doing, and yo, this is what I'm doing. And, you know, we should link up. And we started linking up, and we go to Kimo's house in his basement, was where we'd all hang out after school. And Kimo would have this little cork sampler where he could sample for like I think 10 seconds or 8 seconds or something, and that's how he was making his beats. He was making taking these little samples like 8 seconds or less and kind of looping them up and making his beats. And we'd always hang out at his house because his brother would have would stay up all night and record all the videos from Rap City. So every time you go there, there'd be a new VCR with all the latest raps and whatnot on it. So Kimo's house kind of where it all set off in his basement, just because, you know, that's where he had the tech. He had two techniques, turntables, and, you know, the little cord sampler, and they had all the rap videos over there. So, you know, we just hang out down there, and Kimo would be playing, spinning records, and practicing, scratching, and sampling little samples and putting them together. And it kind of just all came together super organically. It's like, you know, we were all friends. We were all hanging out. That was our passion and our hobby that we did. And it just kind of turned into a career. So it was kind of cool.
Nice. Was that like the foundation of Ragamuffin Rascals?
Ah, definitely. I think we even had, did we have another name before that? I don't even know. I just remember once we decided, like, yo, we're going to, let's do it. I just remember we were all like, there was a week or so where we were just, everyone was just, every time we'd hang out, they'd be throwing names. What about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? And, you know, we finally decided, like, back then, we were always not only big into hip hop, we were big into reggae music too. And ragamuffin was the term for, you know, a roughneck ragamuffin. That was the terms. Them times for like hardcore rude boy type of style. So being that you know, we always wanted to encompass reggae and hip hop into our music, I kind of came up with the name Ragamuffin Rascals because it kind of like, you know, a hip hop name and a reggae name mixed in one. That kind of be
even,
a good.
Yeah, even Calypso too, you know?
Yeah. So we just wanted to kind of just express our vibes through our name. And that's kind of how that came about. But then after a while, we're like, oh, this is too long. It's just everybody had one name. You know, back then it was like people had longer names, Leaders of the New School, and A Tribe Called Quest, and all that kind of stuff. So we thought it was kind of cool to, you know, have a long. Then we just were like, yo, nah, man, let's just Rascals. It sounded better.
Yeah.
I'm just like, all right, let's run with that.
And then and pretty much at that point is when you guys dropped Really Living, right?
Yeah, so there's two versions of Really Living. Like, Kimo made the original beat, and we had made the song. And we were doing a lot of shows, a lot of underage shows, and we were kind of getting popular in the city. And we started working with this label called Calabash Records. And we had put out our first, the Ragamuffin Rascal CD. And then, you know, he was like, yo, I'm going to get you guys a deal. We've been talking with Sony and blah, 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 all this other stuff. So it kind of took a while. So we thought, you know, this guy's fucking bullshitting us, And then finally, he's like, yeah, then they want to sign you guys, we're going to do a deal. And they love the record. And they want you, but at that time, with the Ragamuffin and Rascal CDs, like, I remember we were mixing it in the studio and the speakers broke. And so the engineer was mixing the record through headphones. So the finished product wasn't really so sonically sound because we didn't have any, like, loudspeakers to kind of play it out of and compared to while we were doing the mixing, we were listening through headphones. So when he had taken the record to Sony, they were like, yo, we love the record. We'll give you guys a deal. We just want you guys to go back into the studio and just, you know, just work on the sound, fix up the sounds a little bit, mix it, gave us some money, mix it proper. And so by that time, it had taken so long, we were just like, yo, we ain't feeling these songs no more. Because by then, we had new songs, new raps, new everything, and we had, you know, come quite a bit away as far as development and our skills and how we put things together. And so they gave us like 30 days or 45 days or something to put everything together. So we went back in the studio and we redid the whole album, but they had really liked Really Living and they wanted that to be our first video and single. So we had to keep that one. So we spiced up the beat a bit, made it more up to date, and then me and Fit, we changed our lyrics and we redid the song, kept the hook. The beat was pretty much the same, just better drums, better sounds, whatever. And that's the Really Living that most people know. But there's a Really Living before that, which is pretty much the same song, just different lyrics and pretty much 90% the same, more spiced up.
And what was Calabash Records exactly? Because when I looked them up, all I see is like your guy, like the Rascals releases, and then like a compilation. Like what was
that?
Yeah,
pretty much. It was like it was a guy named Michael Moetti. He was an African guy who lived in Vancouver, and he was South African. And he basically was a guy in Van. At this time, this is a time kind of when the Vancouver hip hop scene was kind of just blowing up. There was like tons of groups, R&B singers, you know, solo rappers and stuff. So what he did was he signed a bunch of the artists to his label. And so we were the first group to kind of get a deal. And then, you know, he put together a compilation with a bunch of different artists that and groups that he had signed. Like, I know he had an R&B singer named Mike Desire. He had us. He had another group called, fuck, what were their names? I can't even remember the name. But, like, literally 80% of anyone who was doing anything in Van at the time, seriously, he pretty much signed them to a record deal. And he would put on like shows and showcases where we'd all perform, and you know, tried to put together a little compilation. And because once he kind of got us a deal, it kind of legitimized him a bit, and then you know, everybody was trying to mess with him. And then once we got our deal, Sony, they wanted to sign us directly to their label. So we signed, we went on Calabash anymore, and we signed directly to Sony. And then I know he worked with a few artists for a while after that. And then I'm not sure what happened. Things kind of just fell apart. And we moved on to the major label situation and kind of kept it moving from there.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I would think they, if they did have anything else that was put out, it might have been a few singles from a few of the other artists they had. But nobody else, I don't think, put out a full-fledged record. I know we did the compilation and probably a couple other singles we put out on the Calabash. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how was the creation of Really Living compared to, you know, like doing it in the studio and everything? Like you guys must have felt good, like making all the music more up to date and, you know, feeling better behind.
That was dope, man. Like, you know, because you have all these notions of what it must be like to be a artist signed to a major label. And, you know, now we have money to go get like the biggest studio in the city. We're hyped. We have all these preconceived notions of what it's going to be like once it's finished, and when we put it out, and everyone's going to love it, and we're going to be large. And you know, when you're a young kid and you got dreams in your head, and you see it starts happening, like you just think like, yo, we're about to take over the world. It's crazy. So you know, it's all excitement. Like literally every day after school, we would go to the studio, stay in the studio till like 3, 4, 5 in the morning. Sometimes I'd be leaving the studio, sun's up, I'm just going home to change and head to school. After school, come home and go straight to the studio. So it was wild, man. It was like you were just excited. You didn't even want to sleep. You just wanted to go get it done and to take it to that next level where you actually get to put it out and see your CD in the store, go on tour, see a video on TV. Like, you know, it was like, I definitely remember that excitement of.
Now your video is the one being recorded.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? So, yeah. It was an exciting time for sure.
What
man.
Was that like though? Like coming back home and like, you know, did you guys have, you know, the support of your parents to be able to just go to the studio 3 in the morning and then go to school the next day? Like,
well,
what was
I would definitely
like?
At first. I would be, my mom was always on something like, yo, you need to get a good education because, you know, if the music thing doesn't work, you need to have something to fall back on. And she'd always be pushing that on me. And then, you know, at a certain point, I would be sneaking out of the house and sneaking back in the house to go get this done at the studio. And because we only had a certain amount of time to finish this album. So we were just there every day, all day. And, you know, school night, sometimes I'd be sneaking, going to the basement, sneaking out the basement window, going to the studio, staying there all night, coming home, sneaking into the basement window, back in my room. Like, I don't even think my mom really knew half the time I was out of the house. So, you know, but she was definitely supportive. They definitely, you know, my family was always supporting what I was doing. You know, sometimes I'd come back, the window was locked. I'd throw a rock at my sister's window. She'd run downstairs, open the window, let me in. You know, so my family was out. My sister had my back, you know, my family, they definitely believed in us. And, you know, especially once you started seeing that you're going away and going on tour and doing all these shows and seeing your music, your videos play on TV and having people like, oh, you're his mom. Oh, I love his music. And like, you know, she'd constantly be out and people would just be like, oh, I love your sons. They're my favorite group. And so she was seeing the results in the streets and on
yeah.
TV and hearing our songs on the radio. And so, you know, they knew they were definitely supportive and even a bit more once they seen that we were making it somewhere with what we were doing.
And how old were you at this time?
Man, this all started when I was like 16. Yeah, sixth grade 11 and grade 12.
So yeah, those are the years 16, 17, basically. Yeah.
So those are the years when, and it was crazy because you all this would be happening and you're going to school, and you know your rap videos playing on Rap City, and kids are going nuts when you show up at school like, yo, I did a video and my music last night. So it was kind of cool to be able to experience being in high school and experience that, and you know, like I said, we started off performing at a lot of underage parties because we were teenagers. So
yeah,
by the time we got to the Calabash Records, we were probably the most popular group in the city. Like everybody all over the city, Burnaby, North Vancouver, Surrey, Vancouver, like Westman, like everybody knew about our crew.
The high school thing makes me think of Large Professor. When he was in high school, he was producing for like Kool G Rap and Eric B and Rakim, and then going to high school the next day, and you know, so that just made me think of, you know, it's just, yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, it was definitely on some of those vibes. It was an exciting time. Like, you know, you're a kid, you don't really know much about the world besides how you perceive it, you know?
Yeah.
So,
do you remember why? Pardon me?
No, go ahead.
I was going to ask you if you remember why why Really Livin' didn't come out on vinyl at the time. So I know now they reissued it, but do you know why it didn't come out at the time? Well, it was only on cassette and CD?
I'm not sure, because at first the deal we signed with Sony was like a one-album deal. There was no rap groups signed in hip-hop in Canada at the time. Well, actually, maybe Dream Warriors were out. But Dream Warriors went on Sony. So Sony hadn't invested in any local Canadian hip-hop at the time. So they couldn't really gauge what and how it would do. They just knew hip-hop was blowing up. This is the new music. We need to get into the space. Hey, these guys from Van, and we like their music. It sounds dope. You know, it wasn't like a major big deal. It was like for one record. I'm sure they didn't really want to invest too much money, so they probably just pressed some CDs. Tapes was the thing, and CDs was the new thing at the time that was blowing up the place. And so, you know, people weren't really on records as much.
Yeah,
because CDs had come out. So they just wanted to keep it safe and roll with the CDs and the tapes, because they know everybody had tapes in their cars, and CD players was what everybody was buying at the time. The Walkmans were CDs and tapes. So they were just kind of catering to being able to push as much units with the technology at the time.
Okay.
But I think we had ended up getting some pressed ourselves, because when we did shows with two turntables. So we needed... We needed the instrumental on vinyl. So I think we did do a small run, but it wasn't for stores.
Yeah.
We did, and I think we did end up selling some to play the record, because they did a minimum run. So there was probably like 100 vinyl or something, like 50 or 100 or something. So they gave us a bunch for our shows, and then last year they gave us them all. And I remember we took some records to this famous record store in Toronto on Yonge Street called Play the Record, and we sold that.
Yeah, man. Eugene.
Eugene. So there's probably a few of those circulating somewhere out there. So real collector's item, you can find it.
Yeah, man. So how was the movement from Really Livin' over to Cash Crop?
Well, Really Livin' is so good, sold so many records, and you know, it was such a popular album that we did that they then wanted to sign us for like
think our record deal was like 5 or 6 albums after that. So we got it. Not they offered us a new contract, bigger budget, whatever. So we ended up signing that deal. Yeah, so at that point, then it kind of really started to change, because then, now, you know, on Really Living, we were shooting videos with probably $30,000, $40,000 budgets. And, you know, by the time we got up to Cash Crop, you know, we're doing $100,000 videos. So the budgets have increased significantly, and, you know, we're renting out the top studios for months at a time, and, you know, we got money in our pockets, when now we're doing shows and we're getting advances, and, you know, so it kind of, it just went to the next level. And, yeah, you know, so we just kept going and took the music to the next level with it. So
what would you think is the difference? Pardon me?
I was just saying it kind of just really started opening the door to seeing what the possibilities could really be at that point.
Okay. The whole scope was just opened.
Open. Because now you've traveled, now you've done shows, now, you know, you're in the big offices doing deals, and, you know, you got to go and the radio stations are requesting you, and, you know, you got press days and autograph signings and all those other things. So we got to do that on the first Really Living thing. So now by the time Cash Crop came, we kind of knew the levels and the expectations and the possibilities.
So what was the difference with like creation wise between Really Living and Cash Crop, other than, you know, you're a little bit older.
Better equipment, you know, better equipment to record, to make beats, more confidence, better at your craft, kind of knowing the sound that you're going for and being able to kind of work within those parameters, and just more of a focus on who we were and what we were trying to represent and do. And the kind of music we were trying to make, you know, it was crazy because we were like a pure hip hop group. You know, we had the MCs, we had the DJ who was a slash producer. We had the B-Boys. They were graffiti artists. They had their own crew called the AA crew, which is a famous Bang City crew when it comes to graffiti and stuff like that. Like Cash Crop is like a 100-foot mural on some wall in Vancouver that they did with spray cans and stuff like that. And that album cover is a picture of that wall.
I was going to ask you if you remember that day.
The day that we did the wall?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, you're in Van and, like, right downtown, there's this massive picture of your face grinning. Like, having this sly grin on your face. And, you know, I was proud, like, and, you know, it was up there and nobody messed with it or sprayed on it or did nothing, because at that point, we've gotten to the point where, you know, everybody was proud we were from Vancouver and they would support us. And, you know, it was like one of those things where it's like, yeah, they're dope. They're from here. To this day, cats still be like, yo, they're from Toronto. And cats like, no, they're from Van. Like, you know, so... It was one of those things where you see it went from like, yeah, it's whatever, it's all right, to like, yeah, that's dope, man. And they're from here, we checking for them, you know what I mean? So at that point, that's kind of what was going on at the Cash Crop stage.
And how long did that mural run for?
We were up there for years. Years.
I didn't even know it was a mural until Kimo told me that, and I was like, "Oh, crazy, man!" That's
yeah, man.
And it makes sense because of what you said, because you guys being a full out hip hop crew, all elements being
yeah. Even if you look in the video of top of the world and stuff, you see our b-boy dancers, our break dancers in there, they're doing a mural in that video too. And like, you know, Deados is like Deados is world renowned for his art. Like, he's sick. So literally our days and nights were just, even when we weren't in the studio and we were just hanging out, because we would hang out every day, even if we weren't doing music, we would just be at the crib playing beats. Deados would be in his book drawing some new piece or some new Rascal piece. Like, there's so many Rascal pieces people haven't seen that are just ridiculous. Like, Deados is next level. So, or Kimo would be in the corner practicing his cuts. You know, we'd just be hanging out. And, like, that's just what we did. They'd be in the back practicing breakdancing. And it was just our lifestyle. Like, we were, like, legit, real hip-hop. Had B-boys, graffiti artists, DJs, MCs, producers. And that's all we did every day, all day.
Yeah, the book, I picked up the Elements book with all the Deados drawings, all the art from Deados in the middle of it, of all the hip-hop artists over the years. And it's just crazy, man.
It is. And that's nothing, bro. I'm telling you, he has books with shit that you would be like, get the fuck out of here. Like, you just see all the options we had for the Rascal covers. There's one where we're on two massive polar bears and we got on these parkas with the fur and we're holding the reins and like we're walking through, coming through the tundra. And it's like, there's so many pieces that people have never seen that it would blow your mind.
Oh, man.
Well, yeah, like, it was just a lifestyle, bro. Like, you know, a lot of people, groups especially, they're put together and contrived. But the best thing about us is we were all friends and we just all took a different element of the art that we were interested in and made it our thing, and it just was natural progression that we just became this conglomerate of just B-boys, MCs, DJs, producers, and graffiti artists. It was just a thing. Like, we didn't even make it to be like that. That's just how it ended up. And on top of that, we were all friends. We all hung out with each other every day.
Yeah. Yeah. So, part of that cash crop was receiving a Juno. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys refused the Juno, correct?
Yep. Because at that time, hip-hop had become the number one selling music. It was like the number one record around the world, everywhere. All the hip-hop artists were like, it was all over the charts. So we felt like, you know, the Junos, they had a Saturday night where they had a pre-award show and a Sunday night. And they wanted to give us our award on the Sunday night. And, you know, on the Saturday night, on the pre-award dinner gala. And then on the Sunday night, they'd be giving out awards for the best children's instrumentalists and the best folk song. And, like, and not to say one genre of music's more important than the other, but when you're dealing with like what is now taken over from rock and roll and country music as the number one genre of music, like, we feel like it deserves more respect than a pre-award gala. We think hip hop needs to be front and center on the main stage and getting its due for everything, all the hard work. And we kind of felt like we earned that. And so, you know, at the end of the day, we were just like, listen, we know we're new to this industry. And, you know, we're very grateful for, you know, being considered through our music for this award. But we'll respectfully have to decline because we feel like, you know, urban music, hip hop, reggae, you know, R&B, all that. We feel like we've worked hard over the years to earn our spot and to earn the right to stand on that same stage as everybody else. And so, till we feel like, you know, hip hop's getting that same respect as every other genre of music, we'll just have to decline. But we appreciate it. Thank you.
Amazing. Because, you know, a year later, they were asking you guys to perform.
Exactly. Because they knew what we do. And, you know, I get it. It's a corporate thing, and you're not necessarily pressed into the pulse of what's going on the streets or what's going on, you know, at the very second, you know, it takes some time for things to trickle uphill to get that recognition. So, you know, I get it. And, you know, once it was brought to their attention, they weren't like, oh, fuck these guys. They think they're this or they think they're that, or how disrespectful or how ungrateful. They were like, you know what? Yeah, yeah, that's right. You're right. It's time. And you know what? We want you guys to come perform. We were nominated again for another award. So, and the best part about it is at that time we were nominated for Northern Touch. So it didn't make it seem like it was a rascal issue, because we didn't want it to be a rascal issue. It was a hip hop, urban music, R&B, reggae issue. So when we got to go on the stage and perform, we went on to do Northern Touch. So we had Cardi with us, we had Shawclair with us, we had Thrust with us, we had Checkmate with us, we had Shawclair with us. So the best thing about that was we had the hip hop fraternity on stage representing, and it wasn't, well, the Rascals declined their award, and now the Rascals get to perform this year, and the Rascals, it wasn't Rascals, it was hip hop, and that's what made it actually special for me, because if it was a thing where it was just, okay, well, the Rascals, they protested, and now the Rascals are performing this year, I think it would have made it too much about us. Versus what we were actually trying to make it about. So everything kind of, you know, everything worked according to God's plan.
Yeah, man. So first EPMD used that sample. And then you guys used the Northern Touch sample. You guys made Northern Touch and used that same sample.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had DMX and Mace come out with the same sample the same year.
Same time, like
how did you feel about that?
The same month.
Pardon me.
I felt the same month.
But like, I feel like yours came out first, right?
Ours came out first. His came out right after. But you know, I felt like that's hip hop. Hip hop, we take. You can make music from scratch, or you can take music and just remix it, refiddle it, and come up with your own creation. And you know, they say great minds think alike. So I felt two ways about it. I was just like, oh, man. And on the other hand, I was like, oh, fuck, that's dope. Because now I'd go out to the club and I'd hear, get at me, dog. Like I'd hear DMX, and right after they'd mix, we notorious. And that was happening in Canada. That was happening in the States, because Northern Touch was playing on BET at the time, too. The American DJs were all up on it. So not only was it dope, because X is dope and I love DMX, but it helped propel the song, because the DJs had something to mix it with and mix it into. So
yeah, it's like it gave them a tool.
It gave them a tool that which helped promote the song and made it even bigger, in my opinion. So, you know, it was a bit of good and bad, because we knew it was dope, and you wanted when that beat came on for people to be like, yo, that's that Rascal joint, which they did. But on the other hand, you know, DMX did his thing and it made it dope, because X was large and Rough Riders was like the largest thing at the time, and it helped propel the song because they always mix the songs together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I ain't mad at it.
Yeah. So, but Northern Touch was kind of after Cash Crop, right? It wasn't at the same exact time.
Well, we made it right when the record was finished, but the label liked the song so much that after the first pressing of CDs, when they were pressing up the second press, we inserted it into the album, and it helps even more CD sales. Some people are like, yo, I already had the album, but it didn't have Northern Touch on it, so I had to buy it again. So a bunch of people told me that they had two copies of that, just because they ran out and originally got it when it came out. And then Northern Touch was such a smash that they wanted it too, so they went and got it again.
Yeah, that's funny. I feel like I'd be one of those people, you know?
Yeah, because back then, you know,
that
like,
version, that version.
No, because that back then people would go actually go and buy CD singles, and they would go buy just the song, but we didn't put it out as a CD single. We put it out as on part of the album, so they just went and got the album just to get the song.
Yeah, I was really happy with the re-release last year, because you guys had the extra Solitaire remix and the regular one. Think.
Yeah,
and you also put the Northern Touch out there on that one too, so it was good to have like the extra joints on vinyl.
That's dope, man. That's dope.
Yeah. So how long did it take after, you know, all the buzz of Northern Touch to start working on Global Warming?
We probably toured and performed that album for about a year, and then we started on Global Warming. We probably had one or two joints, you know, because you write here and you write there, and you're on tour and you don't really know anybody in a certain city or town you're in, so you just stay at the hotel and you're bored, and you just pull out your rhyme book and you start writing songs. And so one or two of those songs, you know, a few of them had been created, like, you know, while we were out touring and performing the records. But I'd say we officially went into the studio and cracked the budget open and started doing things probably like a year later, the very next year.
Do you remember what those tracks were that you wrote while you were on tour?
I actually don't. I don't, but I just know,
that's
like,
cool.
I remember having certain songs ready when we started going to the studio. Usually we'd be in the studio, and as Kimo's making the beat, we're sitting right there next to him writing the lyrics. But I remember being in the studio, and he had a couple, we were going through beats to fit the song. But we don't usually work like that. We usually, while he's making the beat, we're like, yo, this is dope. Let me jump on the pad and start writing to this. And literally the songs and beats would be made up at the same time.
Okay. When did you think of putting Barrington Levy on the album?
See, okay, so that's a song that was probably made before we had finished, because I actually initially made that song and made a beat for it. And the beat had the sample, the dun 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 dun. So, but I actually sucked at making beats. So Kimo was like, and then, you know, so I played him the beat. And then I said, yo, this is the hook. In New York, they want me, and I'm gonna be, because I've always loved Barrington Levy, and I always wanted to remake that song. So I said, okay, this is it. He's like, that sample's fucking crazy. Your beat's trash. But I'm gonna take the sample and I'm gonna make a dope beat from it. So he took the sample and turned it into what you hear now is Top of the World. But yeah, that song I had written before, and Saul Guy, our manager, I think he was like, yo, because I remember I was singing the hook. He was like, why don't we just get fucking the original guy to sing the hook? I was like, that would be dope. Because at this point, we hadn't really gotten no features, especially like famous, like legendary people on our site, much less, we haven't had no regular artists besides like, you know, local guys that we're friends with, like Cardi and Chop Lair and those guys.
Yeah.
So thinking that this guy, this famous legendary reggae artist out of Jamaica, is gonna come sing the hook. I was like, okay, sure, if you can get it. I was just like, whatever. But that's one of the benefits on being signed to a major label. Somebody from Sony just contacts. So I think it was Saul, because he was working at the label at the time. And he was like, yeah, he's going to do it. He's flying in. He loves the song, first of all, and he's flying in on this date. And that studio session was like the most amazing thing I've ever witnessed in my life as far as somebody recording a song. Like, literally all day, he has us running around with him, and he's telling jokes, and we're like, I'm like, yo, don't you want to go over the song? He's just, So we're running around to all these, because all these DJs knew he was in town, so they were trying to get these things called dub plates. They just play him, and he sings whatever song, the legendary song of his they want, and he calls their name out in it, and now they have it, so when they go play at a dance, they're playing their original version of the song. So I just remember sitting at some studio, and we're doing this all, like, literally he's making thousands of dollars. It's like a lineup of DJs, because all wanting dub plates. Then we're going to eat, and we're hanging out in the hotel, and the whole time he's just cracking jokes and whatever. I'm like, yo, you got to go to the studio in like an hour, bro. Do you want to go over? He's like, don't worry, man. Everything good. So we're in the studio, and I remember me and Chaos were sitting there, and we lay our shit down, and now it's time to lay down the hooks. This guy's there. He's smoking weed. He literally has a cigarette in his hand. The beginning of the song, of the top of the world, you hear this at the top. It's because he just took a puff of a cigarette and it made him cough. So that's how the actual song starts. So you hear at the top.
Yeah.
So literally, the guy takes a puff of a fucking cigarette, blows it out, coughs, says at the top. One time. Just lays the chorus. I just remember me and Chaos looked over each other with our jaws dropped because literally, like, pitch perfect, one take, just, we're like, yo, this is a hit. Just, like, that's the first time I actually heard a record that we did or heard somebody lay down something and called it out, like, yo, immediately, this is a hit. This is fucking crazy. I couldn't believe it. And he was out. It, like, literally took him, like, 10 minutes. To lay down the hooks. He did the first one. Okay, what cities? In New York, Van City, T-Dot, boom. Okay, what's the next cities? India, Japan, done. Last one, what's the... Mama Africa's calling. This city, that's it, done. Let me run it back one more time. And then you just throw it in a 1-2. Like the whole ending part. And done. So literally one take of the whole fucking song, there was no, start again, run it again. Oh, fuck, let me do that again. Like, there was none of that. One fucking time. It's the only time I've ever seen that happen, recording with anybody.
Crazy.
It's fucking crazy, bro.
And that's why he was probably so cool throughout the whole day. Like, yeah, don't worry.
No, because this is just regular shit for me. He's just like, yeah, I do this, bro. Don't worry about that.
Yeah,
it was definitely one of the great best vibes of past the studio.
Pardon me?
Huh?
You kind of zoned out there. What'd you say? Sorry.
So I was saying it was definitely one of the best vibes I've had in a studio recording with somebody. Sure.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to see him live in Montreal one time, and it sounded exactly like the record.
Exactly.
And like all of his tracks that he performed sounded exactly like the record, and it blew my mind because he was at least 60. You know, this is probably a few years after you guys did that track, you know? Probably a good five years after you guys did that track. And he was nailing everything. Like, everything was on point.
And still does it. To this day, we're still friends. I'll get like video calls from him and it's like, Red! Hey, yo, what's up? Like, I'll go to his house when I'm in Jamaica, go visit him and shit like that. Like, you know, he comes to Van, he does shows, hits me up, like, you know, we've kept in touch over the years, and you know, he's definitely one of my favorite persons for sure in the industry, 1,000%.
Man, Kimo said how Saul gave a CD to Puff Daddy, and then a few days later saw Puff Daddy bumping the CD and telling him how he loved the Barrington track, and then not long after
track came up. I know it for a fact because I spoke to Barrington, and Barrington said to me, he's like, yo, Diddy called him and said he loves the song we did. I'm going to New York to record some music. That came straight from the horse's mouth. So this isn't rumors or speculation. It's facts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back then, he did a song. He has two songs out for Shine.
Sorry, man, you cut out there for a second.
He has two songs on that album with Shine. Bad Boy song, and what's the other one? I know we inspired that song. Well, not that. We didn't inspire the song, but we put the idea in Puff's head to draw for Barrington Levy for Shine's record.
Yeah.
And it was his biggest song. Man, a bad boy on the corner, so move from on ya, because we are dangerous.
Yeah, man, so. That was... Yeah, man. Definitely started a good Barrington presence for a while there in hip-hop.
Yeah, we definitely have our influences, and you kind of have to be in the know to know, but we've definitely influenced hip-hop in a few major ways in Canada and in the States. So, you know, that's just one of those moments in time where you're just like, nobody got to know, you know, and you're proud of it.
Would you say that, you know, when you say that, I'm looking at the Global Warming record here, and I'm looking at the Bret the Hitman Hart name. Did you guys do a wrestling collabo before Wyclef and The Rock?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I was
a big wrestling fan, and initially they had our record label was like Bret the Hitman's doing a documentary called Wrestling with Shadows, and he's a Rascal fan, and he wants to probably his daughter or his kid or somebody is a Rascal fan, but he's like, yo, he wants you guys to, you know, to do a song for a compilation that's going to go with it. So that song wasn't supposed to be on our album, but we did the song. Again, our label was like, oh, this is dope. We love it. I think you should do a video with Bret the Hitman Hart. And the video was supposed to be just a little side promotion for his documentary. And then, you know, the label starts doing their thing, and then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, we're going to put on a record. And you know, I mean, people like it. Oh, I'm just like, whatever, man. That's not even what we're on. I like the song, but. And I love Bret the Hitman Hart because I grew up with watching Stampede Wrestling, so I know the whole Hart Foundation from time. So that's the reason I did it, because I was a wrestling fan and I'm a Hart Foundation fan. So,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't no big deal, but like initially that wasn't really made for that record. It just ended up on that record.
Mm-hmm. And you guys had some other, you know, like you said, mostly before that album, you guys had.
I think the Beatnuts is on that one, no?
Yeah, I was gonna say. So there's Beatnuts, there's KRS.
KRS One is on that.
You guys got an Alchemist beat.
Yep.
I was gonna ask about how that came out. Was he touring in Van, or were you guys link up at another part of the world? Like what was that?
Alchemist was doing was he doing the Soul Delicious stuff?
Well, Dilated
People. Yeah, so we hooked up, like we were doing shows all over the place, and you know, anybody who came to Van that was popping, the promoters would always have us on the show too. So we started meeting a lot of American artists and, you know, their producers, and we just became cool. Like, they were just like, yo, we like your stuff, and, yo, this is dope. And we'd see them at
the conventions, or we have a show in the state somewhere and run into them, and so you just keep running into the same people over and over, and you slowly become friends and stuff like that. So, like, we've been friends with Swollen. I mean, Hieroglyphics, and you know, Deep Nuts, and just all kind of artists. Like, you know, you just, they become your peers, kind of thing. And that was the cool part for me, because like, you know, Alcoholics, and they would all like come mess with us, and you know, we'd go on tour for 6 weeks across Europe with Common, and like, then you just build this rapport with them, and you know, you can see that they really respect you for what you're doing, and as much as you respect them for what they're doing. And that was actually one of the really cool things, just having all these artists that you were big fans of, like, showing the same appreciation for what you do as you have for them. So, you know, that was one of the trophies, unseen trophies of the music, you know, having KRS-One invite you to New York to come be in the video and go in the studio, and like, what, KRS-One wants us to come to New York and he wants to go in the studio? That's crazy. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, so yeah, it was a trip, man. Those were the silent rewards. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Those were all the silent rewards, whereas, like, not the Junos and the, you know, the MT, the Much Music Awards and all that stuff. Those were cool, too. But to me, the real rewards was, like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, becoming a you know, part of that hip-hop history. And like you said, having everybody as your peers, you know. That's
Yeah, just being a part of the fraternity, man, and just having people, legends and idols and people you're a fan of, turn around and tell you, yo, man, I love this joint, or I like your guys' shit is dope, man, or yo, man, I'm going on tour, yo, come with us, like, you know, we toured the Beat Nuts, Souls of Mischief, Common, Care, like, so many different people that you were, like, literally banging their music hard all day, every day. Now you rocking shows and rocking stages with them, and it's just like, yeah, that's dope.
What was it like doing a track with Muzion as the Montreal group?
They're dope, man. I like those guys. They're really humble cats, and, you know, they made dope music. I was a fan of their music also, and then they ended up being on the same label as us. So it made it even easier. But I always thought they were super dope, man. I like the way they mixed the melodies and the lyrics. And as per people, I really like those guys as persons. You know, they were really, really humble and nice people.
Did you record that in Vancouver?
To be honest with you, bro, I can't even remember where we recorded that. We might have recorded in Montreal. We did a few shows together, so. Where did we record that? Probably. Yeah, I can't remember, man. It's been so many sessions and.
Oh, that's
a lot of weed and alcohol.
Yeah.
So had to ask. Sometimes had to ask. It's all a blur.
I remember.
If you asked me what year something was, I definitely can't tell you what year it was.
No, I'm not going to do that to you. But I remember I recorded a special on Much Music, like on VHS years ago. And you guys, like, Rascals had traveled to Africa. I don't know if you remember what I'm talking about. What was that
War
trip
Child.
About?
We War Child.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know,
exactly.
It was just about doing a documentary on, like, you know, the child soldiers and the Blood Diamonds, and, you know, how there was a war going on in Sierra Leone and Liberia, and how, you know, to fund the wars, and all these kids were being kidnapped and from villages and being turned into child soldiers to fight the war. And not only that, you know, they're being forced to work in these mines to dig for diamonds so that they could sell on the black market to get money to buy weapons to fund the war and stuff like that. And, you know, we hooked up with War Child and had an opportunity to kind of go to Africa, and in the middle of a war zone, you know, we were flying on United Nations helicopters and staying in, like, United Nations bases in the middle of the jungle and stuff like that. And, you know, but it was cool because, you know, when they seen us and we were there, it was just like, it was just pure love. And, you know, we got to go visit the camps where all where the refugees fleeing the war were, and people who have been affected by the war, and people, you know, little kids and adults who had arms and hands amputated, and, you know, because that was a thing. They would amputate body parts to kind of and leave you alive to kind of, you know, just strike fear into the people and stuff like that. It was wild, but it was heartwarming and eye opening at the same time. And it was the first time I got to go to Africa, and beautiful place, and, you know, kind of changed me. So that was I was very blessed to be able to be a part of that, and be able to share that with you know, the rest of the Canadian culture. When we came back, it was part of Much Music aired it like multiple times, and, you know, all the newspapers and people, and it kind of just helped bring light, because I thought hip hop was such a big part of spreading the bling bling culture and the diamonds, and, you know, and I felt like a lot of people don't know, you know, while you're out there, you know, promoting all the bling bling and Ice-T